Chapter 8 Gang HBO Young Comedian Special. It was 1989 and I was still kicking around the improv, averaging 2 weeks on the road and 2 weeks in town trying to get auditions and doing spots. My third attempt to get on the HBO Young Comedian Special was just around the corner. This time I had a foot in the door because Brillstein Gray was producing the show that year, and Brad Gray is one of my managers along with Mark Gervitz. I felt like this gave me a great shot at getting on. When the showcase came around, I knew they were looking for 5 comics. You forget that they're also looking in Chicago, New York, all over the country, not just L.A. This special was a huge deal in a world with 4 networks and barely any cable channels. Even with what I viewed as a leg up, I was sweating it out. When the showcase came around, I decided not to do the set I had done the previous 2 years. I felt I couldn't repeat it. It didn't work twice anyway, so this seemed like a no-brainer, but a tight set is a security blanket. It is usually pretty foolproof. When you're a comedian, you create a set that you know it works for you, and you find yourself going back to it. It just happens. You have your go-to 6-minute set, your 10-minute set, your 30-minute set. For the showcase, the producers usually wanted to see 6 minutes. I knew I had to shake it up. Even if I had a great 30-minute set, the 6 minutes I auditioned with had to be better than great. So it's hard to take a risk and gamble with material that isn't tried and true. This may sound stupid, but that's all we comedians think about. The night came around, and when I did my set, I felt pretty good about it. Even though I'd stepped outside my comfort zone, I did a newer bit about doctors recommending Nuprin for pain over Vicodin, and I threw in my Michael J. Fox impression. Why I waited so long to bring out this nugget, I don't know. There were a lot of good comics in the showcase, though, and I knew I had to wait to hear my fate. This was not easy. I started calling my managers every day to get feedback. I was so thirsty. And at first, I heard I had a spot in the special, so I was over the moon. Then days went by, and then I started to hear that, though I did well, my managers weren't sure if I had a spot. Now word gets out of some other guys who got slots. So now I'm starting to shit my pants. I haven't been confirmed. Was I getting passed over again? Dennis Miller was hosting that year, and he was my favorite comic at the time. I even knew him a little bit. He was also with Brillstein Gray as a client. I felt that this is one more piece of the puzzle that should get me on. I should fall into the right place at the right time category. Next comes word that HBO is passing on me. This hurls me into the beginnings of a deep depression. I realize my career is falling apart. I came out of the gate big with Police Academy 4. Big is relative, okay. And then turned down a Fox pilot. It got canceled after 2 years, but only because I didn't star in it. That's what I'm convincing myself. My entire career and the possibility of ever getting laid again were riding on the fact that I need to get this HBO slot. I'm in the dumps. I hate showing my face back in Arizona, where half the people don't want me to do well because they're jealous, and the other half want someone from their city to put the town on the map, and I wasn't doing it. It was awful. I finally got a call. They liked you, but you are their 6th pick, and they only have room for 5. Buzzkill. Cue theme from MASH, Suicide is Painless. The 5 that were chosen were Jan Karam, Fred Stoller, Warren Thomas, Rob Schneider, and Drake Sather. All good comics. I didn't know how to take this news. Again, I was good, but not good enough. Then Dennis Miller and Brad Gray started pushing HBO to use me on the show. They didn't want to kick someone else off. They just wanted to jam me in. Somehow they talked HBO into spotlighting 6 instead of 5. This was the first time it had ever happened, and it happened for me. We would all just do shorter sets. No problem. Major relief, actually. I was on cloud 11. Mom was happy, and the couple of assholes back in Arizona who wanted me to fail could suck a dick. The way HBO did a special was they would pick a theater, pack it with comedy fans, and tape 2 shows in 1 night. Then they would cut those 2 shows together and use your best material, combined with shots of whichever was the best audience. All the comics they had chosen were great. I knew it would be hard to stand out. By the night of the taping, I was shaking in me boots. It was like I was back at Arizona State about to go on at Greek Sing. Actually, I wasn't as freaked out as I had been that night. I had Dennis Miller to help me relax this time. Plus, I had just done a week-long guest in on Baywatch, so my hair was extra blonde and bouncy. I was feeling really good about that. Unfortunately, I was also pretty sure I'd contracted Hep C because I had to go into the ocean for 5 minutes during shooting. I felt like that was enough time in the sewer to catch something gross. It was like swimming in a payphone. To add to my nerves, one of my all-time rock heroes, David Bowie, was in the audience that night. I don't know why he was there, but holy shit, Ziggy Stardust was in the stands, and it made everything more terrifying. I watched everyone else's set before I went on, and one thing shocked me. Warren Thomas wasn't that prepared. He went out and just started talking to the crowd, saying things like, what else is going on? What do you do? What's this guy up to? You guys married? It seemed like he was finding jokes as he went along. I asked him afterward why he did that. He said, I don't like to prepare it all perfectly. I usually just let it flow when I'm at the clubs and see what happens. I'm good on my feet. I admired the balls of this, but it was something I would never have done or even considered. I had worked my act for weeks, deciding which lines to say, when to say them. If something came out spontaneously, great. But I had my 7 minutes ready to go. When my turn came, things seemed to go my way. The crowd was great to me. I had a strong set. And when I saw the show air, they wound up using almost everything I did, which was a gift. I guess they trimmed Warren way back. He was a great comedian, but that night the crowd was just not there for him, and he lost something very valuable, airtime on a national TV show. The HBO Young Comedian Special is the kind of thing that can land on the desk of someone like Lorne Michaels. And it goes without saying that that's a game changer. A few weeks later, it did just that. I got a call from some people at Saturday Night Live that they saw my set. My manager was at the Brillstein Gray Company, and the legendary Bernie Brillstein had handled SNL talent his whole life, from Belushi to Gilda Radner all the way to Lorne Michaels and many in between. Now, to be honest, I was always hoping to get on a sitcom, and SNL was never even in my sights. I wasn't a character guy, and it was way, way, way out of my reach, so I didn't even bother thinking about it. I loved it, but I didn't think about it. Not that sitcoms are easy to get, but I could picture it more. But now I had the chance, and I better mentally get ready. Because you get one shot with them, this is my time to strike. If I tanked, you don't get a serious look for a long time, if at all. This was for real. Both Rob Schneider and I got SNL auditions out of the HBO Young Comedians thing. Rob and I were very tight at this point. We traveled to the same stand-up grooves for years, out of the valley. We lived close to each other, so we hung out a lot. So even though I had a friend in tow, I was still 25 and freaking out about flying to New York and having one of the biggest auditions of my life. But a few weeks later, we took our first class flight from LAX to JFK, and we were put up at the Omni Berkshire Hotel, a hotel I'd actually heard of because they plug it on SNL, and they show a picture of it. This was all quickly becoming too much for me. It was such a beautiful hotel. We didn't have to put our credit cards down when we got there, which was a good thing because I didn't have a credit card. But I was hungry, and this created an issue. I didn't want to order food on my own dime because it was too expensive, but I didn't want to charge it to Saturday Night Live because then Lorne might hear about it and fire me, even though I didn't get hired yet. And if SNL was paying for it, would they get mad that I had a club sandwich twice in one day? I kept warning Rob not to eat too much. He didn't care at all. The whole time I was like, Rob, that soup is $8. Don't get us fired before we're hired. They're going to get fucking pissed. When that $8 check comes across Lauren's desk? I hate right now, actually, that Lauren might read this book and realize Rob and I were drowning ourselves in soup and sandwiches and regret hiring us. He's like, fuck those guys. The audition was scheduled at the famous Catch Rising Star Comedy Club where Rodney Dangerfield and many others started. I heard Michael Shoemaker and Marcy Klein were coming to watch us. These were two of Lauren's right-hand men, even though Marcy was a chick. Marcy was Calvin Klein's daughter, and she played a big role in booking the host and the show. Shoemaker seemed to be the number two under Lauren. This is what I'm figuring out just by asking around. I had no idea. I wanted just some sense of what to expect from the audition. Most importantly, I knew they both had big votes in picking the new cast. I think Jim Downey, the head writer, was there that night as well, along with some other writers. I found out later this was like jury duty to all these guys. They'd rather go to someone else's kid's soccer game. Dennis Miller even came as a show of support for Rob and I, which is very cool of him. Obviously, we were both entirely panic-stricken at the notion of all these people in the audience. This was not a bullshit table read for Alf. This was SNL. That night, there was another comic on after us, and the SNL troupe was there to see him, too. Tom Kenny was very different from me. He was very funny and very high energy. In fact, he later wound up to be the voice of SpongeBob. He was a very cool guy. I sort of got the impression that it was either going to go his way or mine that night. I went on first. We were supposed to do 15 to 20 minutes. When I looked out in the room, the first thing I noticed was that New York clubs were much smaller than I thought. I could never get spots like this when I came to the city in my dirty couch ottoman surfing days. I could only get those cruddy one-nighters in the surrounding towns, so all of this was very eye-opening to me. I also noticed that there were not many people in the room, and about 60% of them were from SNL. all of this going through my head again right before I go on again, which it shouldn't be. Then I get out there and start dishing my A-level material and proceed to eat shit. Dennis Miller had given me a piece of advice a few days earlier that suddenly came to me. When you audition, you don't want to kill it too hard. It sends up a red flag. They'll think you're some polished road act. So by the time I get to my third joke, I think, well, I sure am taking his advice. I sure as hell am not killing too hard. I got a few titters, but it was pretty much crickets across the board, my whole set. I didn't even do my full time. I think I left after 10 minutes trying to stop the bleeding. Little homemade tourniquet. Rob was next. Same situation. Rob had good jokes and he was a funny performer, but it was like the audience was scared to laugh at him. Rob got off at around 10 minutes too. Cut to Tom Kenny walks up and kills from beginning to end. I think he did a full 20 minutes. It was like fucking Arsenio audience out there howling at everything he said. Rob and I hung our heads and went back to our hotel and ordered soup. More soup. That'll fix everything. The next night, Rob and I were back in the club. We were celebrating because we had gotten the call that we were going to be hired as writer-performers. Rob was so ecstatic. I was not. I said, what are you talking about? I don't want to be a writer. I want to be on the show. He said, you start off as a writer like Chevy Chase did and all those guys. It's great news. Maze. I tried to be excited, but honestly, I was just scared. I have no idea how to write a sketch. I barely knew how to write stand-up at this point. The scenario I had pictured, if I somehow got an SNL involved, their brilliant writers giving me funny things to do in sketches. I had no idea how hard the job I was about to get would be. But through the fear fog, I finally shook myself and said, holy fuck, dude, I'm going to be on SNL. I flew back to AZ, and I was chilling in my Motel 6 room when I got the official offer and the terms of my job at SNL. I was hired as a writer for the last four shows of the 1990-1991 season for $900 a week and a $1,500 bump if I was on the show. I remember writing all of this down on the Motel 6 stationery, and I was hoping I would never have to stay at that Motel 6 again. Chapter 9, Getting on SNL. It was mid-April of 1990, and I was flying out to Saturday Night Live to start my new job. It was a scary flight, mostly because I'm scared of everything, but I was in first class, so that made it a little better. I'm such a first-class whore. After years of flying shitty Southwest for stand-up gigs, I couldn't believe that I was now getting the royal treatment flying to my fancy new job in Rockefeller Center. It was back in the days where they had a curtain up between first and coach, and the stewardess would make sure you couldn't even see the people in first class. She would tug that little curtain shut and whisper a condescending, no peeking. It's the rich people up here. Talking to all the panhandlers and coach. Now all I have to do is come up with funny ideas for sketches. For the past 5 years, I'd spent every waking moment when I wasn't staring at girls or freaking out about cash, coming up with jokes for my stand-up. But writing a sketch is a completely different animal. I had spent the whole flight going through all the characters I did in my stand-up, deciding which ones I could put on the table as my own before I started writing sketches. When you work at SNL, you get one free swing when you start to tell them all the characters you have and you want to own. Because the second you walk into the writer's room, they own everything you come up with from that moment on. This is how it was when I was on SNL, anyway. It may have changed since then, but as I've already shared, my strongest characters involve a weak Tom Petty impression with a stolen valet hat. So, characters aren't really my thing. So on this plane trip, I didn't have a ton of great ideas, though I felt like this was my golden opportunity to claim an opera man or Wayne or Garth or something that might hit big. Skateboard pizza guy. Drunk astronaut. I was just grasping at straws, just trying to get something down on paper in case something clicked. When we landed, I headed right to the Omni Berkshire, where they had the great soup and the expensive room service. There's nothing better than having everything paid for. All my life I'd been counting nickels, wearing crappy clothes, pushing my car when it ran out of gas, and here I was, living in a hotel for 4 weeks, for free, after my first class flight. All I had to do was write something funny, or this shit was going to end really fast. The first night after I arrived happened to be a Saturday. Rob and I were invited to come down to see the show before we officially started working on it. Hanging out backstage was really exciting, but it was also overwhelming and chaotic. I had no idea how I would fit in. I knew Dana Carvey and Kevin Nealon from staying at their house when I was starting up. And of course, Dennis Miller was there. So it wasn't like a total sea of new faces, but everyone was running around buzzing and busy with a lot in their mind. I met a few other cast members on the fly and a few writers. I remember talking to John Lovitz for a little bit. He seemed depressed, so I asked him what was wrong. He said, "You know, I'm kind of bummed I'm only in two things this week." I was taken aback. "Wow, well, that's crazy. I would never think you guys count sketches. I just watch and think you're funny, and I'm glad when I see you on." He goes, "Yeah, well, Dana's in five things." That surprised me. I told myself to remember that conversation because I never wanted to feel like that. Lovitz was such a big star to me, and he had such a great job. I couldn't believe he felt bad about having a light week on the show. Later, I would learn just how hard it was to avoid obsessing over those very details. On Monday, Rob and I went down to work together. I wanted to get there at noon because I didn't want anyone saying I was late. Of course, no one gets there before 1, which is one of the pluses of working at SNL. The problem is, I'm not a late-night person. So regardless of when I hit the hay, I'm getting up at 9 a.m. Staying up all night was the worst part for me, but everyone else on staff totally got off on that. It was total crickets in the office until around 4 p.m. That's when the important people started to trickle in. I met Jim Downey, the head writer of the show, who was very cool, but always had a ton of work on his plate, so he didn't have time to baby the new guy. Rob and I were escorted to a tiny room and told, "Here's a wooden desk and a chair. This is your office. Go." There were no computers back then, so we were told to write our brilliant sketch ideas on yellow legal pads and then give them to one of the four assistants whenever we needed them typed up. It was very Mad Men. I met Conan O'Brien, Bob Odenkirk, Robert Smigel, all very nice as they could be for being as busy as they were. Eventually, I started to meet the cast, and before I knew it, it was the Monday meeting with the host. The host that week was Corbin Burnson from the then-hit show L.A. Law. After that Monday meeting, everyone sort of drifted off to write sketches. I was told it would be Corbin ahead of time, so I had a little jump start on my sketch ideas, and that would never happen again. I went back to my tiny office and started scribbling sketches. My first one was not for Corbin at all, because I could not think of a good idea for him. See what I mean? Stand-up comedians write for themselves. You don't know the other person's comedic rhythm, so you just know your own. That was a hard switch for me to make at first. I wound up putting all my eggs in the Jan Hooks basket that week. I had an idea for a sketch about Life Alert, where Jan would play an old lady who was so lonely she kept calling Life Alert just to hang out with the paramedics. As the sketch went on, her reasons for calling would become more and more absurd. "Life Alert! I stuck my hand on the toaster and it's on dark! Hurry!" Life Alert was a big commercial back then, so it seemed timely. That sketch was read 4th out of 43 at the table read on Wednesday. I later learned that being the early read in table reads was a good sign. Mike Shoemaker, one of the talent coordinators, would create the order of the sketches and read-through. It became clear to me later that the first 10 in read-through had the best shot of making it on the show because everyone was ears open, high energy at that point. The read-through room probably had 50 people packed in it from every department. All the writers, the cast, the host, and of course, Lauren. Having the 4th sketch up at read-through was great my first week. Not having the host in it was not. Having the host in the sketch is key. Sometimes the host will choose to drop out of a sketch if they feel they're in too many and replace themselves with a cast member. But really, the goal is to make the host look good, so you're better off writing sketches that include them if you want your sketch to get on. Mine came up 4th, and as it was read, I started to sweat and freak out more than I thought I would. It was such a tense, hot, sweaty, intimidating room that your heart starts pounding long before your turn comes up. When you write a sketch, you get to walk around before read-through and coach people on how you play their parts. Even the host. It's a fun micro-power trip to give direction to the host, I have to be honest. But with more than 40 sketches on every week, the coaching doesn't really sink in. And suddenly you hear the host reading your sketch with some unexplainable Irish accent and you realize you're dead in the water. It's a common practice for hosts to try things as an actor with your characters. "I thought I'd play that character gay. I thought I'd play him tired," or whatever, you know. Sometimes it helps, and sometimes it bombs the fuck out of your sketch, and they don't care at all. But I was in the clear, because I'd gone with a cast member for my sketch, and Jan Hooks is about as good as it gets. I was so desperate for her to really nail it, because I knew it was my first chance to score as a writer. When we finally got to it, I was drenched in sweat. All the other writers are secretly wanting it to die. Jan read it and did a great job. I got some laughs, and then it was on to the next one. Mine was actually decent written because I had so much time with it, and it blended in nicely. No heads turning like, who wrote this piece of shit? The new guy? After about 22 more sketches, there was a break. The second half of the table read is rough. The sketches aren't as good. The host is usually getting tired, and you see Lauren start yawning. You can imagine it's a bit of a nail in the coffin for your sketch. After read-through, Lauren, Robert Smigel, Jim Downey, Al Franken, all head into Lauren's office and lock the door to make the decisions. They write every sketch's name on a large index card and put it on a corkboard. The corkboard has the beats of the show written out. First, there's the cold opening, then the monologue, which doesn't usually get written until Saturday, scaring the shit out of every SNL host. On a side note, it's a sneaky way for a writer to get something on the show if you put a monologue in read-through. Because if it works, the higher-ups will be relieved they don't have to worry about it that week and might even help you punch it up. And you still get all the credit. That's a bonus. Took me a while to figure this out. Because it usually took about 2 hours for the bosses to pick the sketches, it became our ritual to head down to Wally and Joseph's, an old-school steakhouse nearby, for dinner. That place had been there for ages, deep in the theater district and not far from the studio. My pals and I would go sweat it out over our Caesar salad, hoping that our cards would land on the right part of the corkboard that week. The game starts with all the cards on the left side of the corkboard. As the decisions are made, the cards get plugged into the show, into the places that seem right. Back in my time, that might have been like a Wayne's World cold opening card, followed by the monologue, which said monologue to come, then a sketch or two, followed by, you know, a commercial parody, weekend update, a few more sketches. They even had a card for commercials. At the very end of the show, there's room for one more sketch, which is known around the campus as the 5-to-1 sketch, because it airs at 5 minutes to 1 a.m. These are sometimes the most interesting on the show because of the weirdest and the riskiest. That's when the show has the fewest viewers so they can gamble. That night, I was sitting at dinner, obsessing over my Jan Hooks Life Alert sketch, feeling like I had a decent shot of getting something on the air the first week. Dennis Miller had already told me that Rob and I had 4 shows to prove we were good writers and to get a sketch on the air. If that didn't happen, chances were we wouldn't get asked back. So that was rattling around my head, too, as I walked back to the studio. We drifted around aimlessly until we heard, "Okay, door's open, it's all picked." We gathered around the corkboard, ready to meet our fate. Lauren and the rest of the big dogs had already skedaddled because they don't want to hear the bitching, a tactic they used every week I was there. I sneaked in, looked up at the board, searching for my sketch. I started at the end of the show and worked toward the front. My heart sank. No sketch. But what I did notice is that it was pinned on the right next to the sketches near Weekend Update. When I asked what that meant, Shoemaker told me it's because they liked it and it almost got on. You can tell the ones that stayed on the left side were the sketches that weren't even considered. But if it had been moved, it means they thought about it, but yours got outvoted. Shit. Sometimes you're in the show for 2 solid hours, and at the last minute before they open the door, a switch is made and you're out. The worst thing is when you realize not only did you not get any sketches on, but you aren't in any sketches either. In that case, your week is basically over on Wednesday at 10 p.m. That was my fate the first week at SNL. I headed back to the Omni Berkshire knowing that now I only had 3 shows to prove myself. I was tired, beat up, and frankly, scared. As I walked out, I saw all the writers who had landed sketches. They were excitedly talking to the set designers, buzzing around. It just sucked. The amazing thing about SNL, and I rarely say amazing, unlike every LA chick that's on Runyon, who uses it 5 times in every sentence to mostly describe a salad, is that the show isn't even planned until Wednesday at 10 p.m. And the live show is 72 hours away. Also, once the sketches are chosen, the process for how the show unfolds is amazing. The writers immediately go into action talking to set designers, then to wardrobe to pick out the clothes, then to the wig department to discuss hair. Do you want the character to wear a wig, or should the cast use their real hair? It was way more work than I thought, with 1 million decisions to be made. It looked like fun, but I just kept walking because I wasn't a part of any of it. Thursday is rehearsal day for the cast on whatever set is ready, which usually means just tape on the ground where the walls will be after the set designers are done building them. The writers spend Thursday rewriting sketches. I was under the impression, because no one will actually tell you what the fuck is going on there, you have to figure this shit out on your own, that you only came to rewrite day if you had a sketch that got on. That made sense. So I had planned to spend my Thursday night dining alone with a notepad, thinking of new sketches for the following week, instead of the mandatory 15-hour day in the writer's room. I was at the Omni just about to leave for dinner solo because I had no friends outside of the show when Rob Schneider and Jim Downey called me from the writer's room. Where the fuck are you? Since I was in the dark, I said, I didn't get anything on. I'm just hanging out. Downey goes, get up here. You have to be in these meetings. You're a writer. Help with jokes. I was so pissed at Rob. He had known about this meeting for more than a week and never mentioned it. To be honest, it was the beginning of the friction between us. I had totally missed another meeting he was in too, so I couldn't help but wonder why he didn't share that with me. So every Thursday from then on, I was in that goddamn sweaty writer's room, which happened to be the same room where we had the read-throughs. Those Thursdays were torture, especially back then. There was no Instagram to check every 8 minutes. It was 15 hours of trying to add jokes to someone else's sketch to make them score and make them look good. It was very humbling and a tough adjustment for me. I'd only ever written jokes for myself. Now I'm handing over one-liners to a host or a cast member because I was at the bottom of the totem pole. I just got used to it, but honestly, it took me longer than it should have because I'm kind of a dick. The next host up was Alec Baldwin, who turned out to be one of the all-time great SNL hosts. This was his first time hosting and the episode that earned him an Emmy nomination. I remember seeing him at that Monday meeting. He had just come off of Hunt for Red October, and he had this jet black, slicked-backed hair. He looked like a stud. I thought, this dude is a movie star. It's interesting. I met over 100 hosts during my time in the show, and there were definitely moments when I thought, this person has no charisma, little to no talent, and nothing special about them. They just got really lucky. And then there were a handful where I just said to myself, this person is a fucking star. I didn't know what to expect from Baldwin, to be honest, but he's very upbeat, very fun guy, gave all the writers respect, including myself, who was new. He could do tons of different voices, he had a lot of accents. He was and still is exactly what you want from an SNL host. Talented and up for anything. Those are the hosts that score the most on the show. The show was very good that night. On a live show, you get one take. Usually on an average SNL, you get one or two awesome sketches, then a bunch of C pluses, and maybe a solid F. Movie stars come into the show and they are used to multiple takes to get something nailed. It doesn't work that way on SNL. The worst is when a sketch is killing at rehearsals all week, but on Saturday, something trips and it falls apart. Maybe a cast member misses a cue because something happened in wardrobe, or the whole thing just starts to go wrong and the cast spends the rest of the time trying to recapture the magic they had in rehearsals and it just isn't there. But Baldwin, man, he was great in every sketch. He made me see how it's supposed to be done. Meanwhile, this is the second show in a row where I didn't get anything on. I started to feel like I was legitimately in over my head. Andrew Dice Clay was the host for the third show. His episode was the one that got the most attention of the entire season, but the wrong kind. Clay was one of the biggest comedians in the country at the time. He had just sold out two nights at Madison Square Garden, which is a remarkable coincidence because I had just done a gig in the back room at TGI Fridays and it looked pretty full. So it was very similar. Dice had gained a reputation for being a homophobic, sexist pig. His career was peaking and everyone was after him. His exaggerated character always made me laugh, but some people took his act very seriously. One of those people was our own Nora Dunn, a longtime and very valuable cast member on SNL. Nora made it clear she would not perform with Dice, making a crazy situation even crazier. Dice had so much pressure on him, I could tell he was sort of freaking out. He had this buddy with him named Hot Tub Johnny West, who had long hair, and I swear it was a wig, which I didn't know for sure, but it looked like a dead ringer for Steve Perry from Journey. I'm not sure what his job was other than being Dice's friend, but I have a lot of guys in my life who have that job now, so I didn't have a problem with it. And I don't know why they called him Hot Tub Johnny. All I could think of was there was a lot of hair in the filter. Anyway, I could tell Dice was getting more and more tense as the week went on. As a comedian, I couldn't imagine hosting the show, let alone having every person in America watching and hoping you fuck it up. There were definitely a lot of people out there who hated this guy. I would have killed to appear in a sketch on the show, but with no pull, there was no chance. There was no demand for me from the audience, the writers, or Lorne. Once again, I was stuck as the punch-up guy. Dice got heckled by protesters during his monologue, and his big comeback was something along the lines of, "This is the kind of guy that goes in a public bathroom to smell other people's crap." I don't recall the exact quote, but that was sort of the sentiment. It wasn't a great comeback for a guy who probably had a lot of them. And that stumble set the whole show off on the wrong foot. It wasn't the worst show of my run, but with so many people watching, we really needed a home run that night, and we probably hit a double. We weren't helped by the fact that our musical guest that night was Julie Cruz and the Spanic Boys. Sometimes I like to look back at the musical guests and see who blew up after the show and who disappeared. I feel like this week might have been the latter. The last show of my 4-week trial run before the summer hiatus was Candice Bergen. She was stunningly gorgeous and so sweet. In the Monday meeting, you all start out on the same footing. You're just faces in the crowd to the host. The host is obliged to treat everyone equally because they don't know who's important and who is not. As the week went by, most hosts realized that I was pointless. But at that Monday meeting, I got a little bit of eye contact and attention. That was fun. But as per usual, of course, I didn't get anything on that week. I had two shots. One was a sketch I had written with Rob, and one was a bit for myself on Weekend Update. Unfortunately, Rob forgot to put my name on the sketch we wrote together. So when read-through came along, it looked like I was only writing an update piece for myself. I looked like a selfish prick. So I went to Rob and asked him what happened. His response was, "You left at 2 a.m. I stayed all night. I was blurry. I forgot when I handed that thing in. I had left at 2 a.m. because we finished at 2 a.m. I didn't need to do what Rob did and stay around all night in my boxer shorts to show everyone how late I stayed up. It was a little obvious, but it showed Lauren and Shoemaker and Downey that he was there all night. And I think that helped. It was probably smart." Our trial run was over. Neither Rob nor I had landed a sketch on SNL. It was going to be a long summer of stand-up and waiting to see if I still had a job in the fall. I sure hope so. I wanted that fucking soup at the Omni. Chapter 10, SNL, 1990 to 91. After sweating bullets all summer, wondering if I'd get hired back, I finally got the call from SNL. Thank God I did, because I hadn't booked any stand-up gigs for the fall in the hope that I'd be heading back to New York. Looking back, that was pretty presumptuous of me, considering I hadn't exactly set the world on fire on my trial run the previous season. I would have been doubly fucked if SNL hadn't called. Rob also got picked up again, but we were headed back as writer-performers, which still means 95% writer, 5% performer. Rob was fine with this arrangement. Me, not so much. But this is obviously not a job you turn down. As a middle act on the road, which meant better than the opener, but not quite the headliner, I had been making $1,000 a week. My work week on the road was Tuesday through Sunday with Monday as a travel day, so that meant no break, no real day off. It was a rough ride sometimes, and I try not to do so many weeks on the road back to back. I do an off week in the middle of the month so I could do auditions back in L.A. But here's the thing about an SNL gig. I thought I'd start out making something crazy like 10 grand a week. I had about $2,500 a month in bills to pay back then, so I needed to cover at least that, which I was able to do by touring constantly. When I got my option picked up by SNL, I was offered the same salary I'd been given on my trial run. Not 10 grand a week, but a measly, great word, $900 a week, and again, bumped to $1,500 if I actually performed in the show, which is a fucking fat chance. I was grateful, don't get me wrong, but I'm suddenly realizing that $900 came with stress and anxiety from working outside my comfort zone. At least with touring stand-up, I knew what to expect. I knew how to write for myself. I knew how to get laughs. I was relaxed. It sucked traveling all the time, but I didn't go to work every day and be afraid it would be my last. I went back to the Omni Berkshire Hotel. Angel singing. For 2 weeks of comfort and joy before I was forced to move into a microscopic dog shit apartment. I kept my old apartment in L.A. in the Valley, too, so I could come home on weeks off. This kept my expenses high, but I needed a safety net out in L.A. because in case I got fired. I had hoped that SNL was going to be my ticket to the bank, but this wasn't going to be the case right out of the gate. When I got to New York, I learned SNL had hired two new featured players, Chris Rock and Chris Farley. I didn't know it at the time, but both ended up becoming great friends of mine. It's funny because my best friends have come from high school and SNL. Nothing from college, and that's where most people get them. This is in another book I'm doing called Boring Trivia. I had heard about each of them through the grapevine and SNL scouts. Rock was a young Eddie Murphy protege with a dirty, hilarious act. Farley was a sketch player out of Chicago that everyone on staff kept telling me was a superstar breakout performer. Talk about nailing it. Rock lived in Brooklyn, so he drove into work every day. I didn't meet him till table read the first time, and he was a sweetheart. Farley was staying at the Omni too, so I ran into him in the lobby. I first saw him looking confused there. I would later realize this was his look 90% of the time. Everything confused him: ATMs, washing machines, pogo sticks, etc. I recognized him from his headshot, of all things. I approached him to say hi. I think his response was something along the lines of a, "How are ya? Chris Farley, Gallagher Tent and Awning." Chris always said his name just a hair louder than necessary, with a little dip to the side and flip of his hair. This is a move I saw repeated maybe 5,000 times over the course of our friendship. It was his go-to move because it always got a laugh. This immediately put my nerves at ease because I could tell right away he wasn't a cocky showbiz asshole. He was a scared guy to be working at SNL just like me. We walked together to work that day. It was like the first day of school. We stopped at an ATM machine so Chris could take out some money. This was something he did all the time, and I would always bust his balls. He would usually take out $20, which he did that day. Noticing this, I say, "How long is that 20 bucks going to last in New York? Make it 200 so you don't have to hit the ATM every goddamn 30 minutes, dude." But that's just how he was. It was his small-town upbringing. Once he pointed McDonald's and commented there was also one by his house back home. This kind of naivete is why I started calling him Wisconsin Dundee. Everything was new to him, and it was just part of his charm. That was the beginning of our dynamic. Every day I would casually analyze what he did and make fun of it. We did this all day long. And the more he laughed, the more I would do it. It fell into place right away and never changed. If I thought for one second it hurt his feelings, I would stop. But if I ever slowed down, he'd go, "Davey, make fun of me. Look what I just did. Isn't it stupid?" And he knew it wasn't malicious, and it was just our thing. This is starting to sound like The Notebook, so I'll move on. At work, he outranked me because he was a full feature player and I was a lowly writer-performer. But he really wasn't aware of that. I had figured out some of the hierarchy in my four-week stint the prior season. It was good that Chris hadn't been hired as a writer-performer because he didn't really write a lot. But he could be plugged into any sketch and make it better, which made him a very valuable commodity. The first show of the season was like a typical one from the year before. I didn't get jack shit on, and I was just always stuck in the rewrite room punching up sketches that I wasn't in. Sour grapes alert! Luckily, it was becoming fun since I was starting to get to know peeps and feeling more comfortable. Our host for the premiere episode was Kyle MacLachlan, the star of Twin Peaks. The challenge, of course, was coming up with a sketch to do about Twin Peaks, which was a massive hit. We couldn't find the angle. We went in circles for hours, and to Rob's credit, he finally cracked the code in the 11th hour. I think the idea was for Kyle to have solved the murder, but to continue looking for the culprit because he doesn't want the show to end. Downey was very happy when Rob came up with this idea. This, in turn, made me super jealous. Rob was getting the full "for he's a jolly good fellow" treatment while I was getting the "why did we hire you back" stink eye. I do remember that in the Twin Peaks sketch, Chris Farley played a prisoner in handcuffs. He barely had anything to do, but he was still extremely watchable. He made his part funnier than it should have been, and he wasn't given anything funny to do. I could see right away what everyone was talking about. This guy had star potential for sure. He was immediately interesting to watch, and that's a big deal, especially in showbiz. Meanwhile, I'm off to the side gathering dust. For the third show of that season, George Steinbrenner was the host. I'm from Arizona, so I don't understand or give a shit why this guy was hosting. Everyone around me seemed to understand perfectly well because they were all into the Yankees. All I cared about was, how was I going to plug a 65-year-old guy who can't act into my hilarious sketch ideas? I'm pretty sure I wound up writing a weekend update bit for myself again because I was out. Dennis Miller was still hosting Weekend Update, and he was a fan of my writing, so he would always encourage me to write something for that bit. That was nice in a place where no one really gave a fuck. It wasn't like anyone's outright mean to you. It's just that the other writers and performers have their own shit to worry about, and they don't want to get fired either. So when you don't get a sketch on, they weren't sad for you. They were quietly doing mental cartwheels because of the Schadenfreude Festival around the 17th floor. Not super great for the old ego. I was quickly starting to understand where Lovitz had been coming from the first time we met. It was amazing how fast I turned into that same guy. My Weekend Update bit that week was about the looming war in the Persian Gulf. Saddam Hussein had invaded Kuwait in August 1990. So I got two dolls. I used them to explain the war in simple terms. One doll was my big brother Brian, and he represented Iraq. He was a big bully. The other doll was me, and I was Kuwait. I acted out the Brian Iraq doll punching me, holding me down. spitting and sucking it back up, doing all this shit while Kuwait, me, was fighting it and couldn't do anything about it. The United States was my mom coming in to break it up. It was sort of a funny bit, sort of a funny analogy, but nothing special. Still, at least I got something on. I was on the show. Now people in Arizona might believe me when I say I was on SNL. The next show was memorable for two reasons. The first is, it's the show that instigated a sketch idea that I later ran with, and the second reason is that it included one of my favorite and one of the most memorable SNL sketches of all time, the Chippendales sketch. In a side note, I saw a girl writing Chippendales and wrote it down, and she was texting me, "I love the Chippendales sketch," and they spell it Chip and Dale, like it's based on the fucking cartoon from Disney. It's Chippendale. And I've seen that twice since then. I think both people are morons. And I never in my mind would think they thought it was Chip and Dale, but whatever. Okay, Patrick Swayze was the host that week. He was a super cool dude. He was nice to everyone. He was another guy like Baldwin who was up for anything. On Tuesday night, we wrote the sketches. The host came in between 5 and 6, said hello, heard a few pitches, and then went to dinner at Orso. Usually, Lauren would choose a few cast members to go along with the meal to fill the table, make sure the host had a good time, blah, blah, blah. I got asked to attend this dinner often, and I usually went. And that was a tough position to be in because I wanted to be around Lauren and the host and possibly be amusing at dinner, but it also meant that I was pushing back my writing session even later. I never drank at those dinners because I knew I had to write afterwards, and I sure as fuck can't picture not drinking at them now. I actually can't picture not drinking at any dinner in my life now. On this particular night, at around 9:30 or 10, Patrick came back with us, and they did a little FaceTime with each writer. Like he would hear their ideas and give feedback off the top of his head. This kind of meeting can be very valuable, because this is when you find out whether or not your host can do a German accent, or if he'd like to play a hillbilly, or any useful information that will help your sketch. Or sometimes they'll kill it on the spot. I've seen sketches be 90% done, only to be killed when the host casually goes, "Yeah, I don't want to do anything political." Then your sketch is dead on arrival. You just have to stop writing, start over. It's heartbreaking. On this particular night, I asked where Patrick Swayze was because I had been out of the office when he came by. I heard he was still in the writer's room, so I headed over. I peeked in and was surprised to see Patrick sitting alone, just reading, without being smothered by writers or cast members starfucking him. So I thought, wow, this is my chance to starfuck him. Plus, I had some wispy ideas that I wanted to run past him. So I started to walk in, and out of nowhere, his publicist stepped in front of me and blocked the doorway so I couldn't get in. I looked at her arm in front of my face, and I turned to her with sort of a quizzical, "What the fuck are you doing?" look. And she goes, "Hi, can I help you?" And I go, yeah, I just wanted to chat with Patrick for a second. And then she hit me with those three magical words I'll never forget. "And you are..." I was a little taken aback. I never run into any resistance walking up to a host, especially in the writer's room where I hang out. But I play along. "Oh, I'm sorry. I'm David Spade." "Right. And this is regarding..." I go, I'm a writer. I just wanted to tell Patrick about a sketch." In my head, I'm wondering, why was I talking to a stranger that didn't care to tell me who the fuck she was? As you might have guessed, her response was, "Yeah, he is just so swamped right now. Can you come back later? It's just so nuts." I peered over her arm. "Isn't that him just sitting there reading People magazine?" And of course she fired back, "Yeah, it's just a really bad time." I gave up. I walked away confused but laughing at how ridiculous this attitude was. That convo stuck in my head for a full year until I tweaked it, and it became one of my first and best-known sketches, The Receptionist. Jim Downey wrote the famous Chippendale sketch that made Chris into a breakout star. It was only the fourth show of the season, but after that, there was no turning back for him. It was the kind of dream part that everyone wishes they could get. It used all of his strengths, including physical comedy, his surprising dancing ability, and his sweet and vulnerable acting. The real unsung hero of the sketch was Patrick Swayze. I don't know if he gets enough props. He played his role so perfectly, and it made Farley even funnier. Swayze had an impressive dancing background, and he was this perfect male specimen with ripped abs and long hair. And then there was Chris, the polar opposite, the sloppy, out-of-work, chubby everyman. To put them both side-by-side auditioning for a spot at Chippendale's Dancer was just pure comedy gold. It was one of those sketches that had almost no margin of error. It was funny from the concept to read through to dress rehearsal to air, and it never faltered. A lot of sketches are hilarious in read through, and then when you put them on their feet and act them out, they lose something and it doesn't quite work. Sometimes no one can put their finger on why. It was just better at read through. Some sketches barely squeak through at read through and gain momentum during the week with better jokes and punch up, great performances, and they blow it through the roof on Saturday night. This one had high hopes from the get-go, and it came through big time. I still quote this sketch when Kevin Nealon announces his decision and addresses both of them going, "Adrian, Barney." Adrian was a perfect name for Patrick's character, and Barney was spot on for Chris. In fact, he should have been named Barney in real life. I also love the moment after Farley realizes he's not getting the job and starts making sexy faces at Nealon to try to change his mind. He's staring at him and moving around. Kevin goes, "Barney, Barney, it's over, Barney." Like, stop, stop, Barney, come on. Still makes me crack up. I think many people of our generation would say it's one of their favorite SNL sketches ever. It was an instant classic. So now Chris is off and running, and every writer started putting him in every sketch because he would score for sure. The pressure on him was instant. Around this time, maybe late fall, one of my other buddies got hired, Adam Sandler. Adam was a comic from New Hampshire who also lived near me in the Valley. We had met at a comedy club a few years earlier and hung out a lot back in the Valley. And Adam was such an easy guy to chill with. We would get together and drink, do sets at clubs, play tennis, whatever. Rob was usually around, and so was Judd Apatow, who lived with Sandler at the time. Judd was another cool dude with a funny act, good writer. Alan Covert lived there too. Jack Chirapudo, who was Sandler's producing partner for years at Happy Madison. But at this point, we were just a bunch of dumb idiots struggling in the Valley, trying to get laid, get drunk, do some stage time. Dennis Miller, Rob, Fred Wolf, and I had all mentioned Sandler to Lauren and the other talent scouts whenever we could. Not that some of us had great job security ourselves, but he was a pal. When he got there, he was a workhorse, a great addition to the show right away. He knew Chris Rock some, so he shared an office with him. I shared an office with Farley. Mind you, these offices were 10 by 10 feet. Not only were they tiny, but you had to walk through me and Farley's office to get to theirs, which was frustrating 1% of the time, but super fun the other 99%. Adam was always very good about doing his homework. He would get in the office and work on a weekend update piece or a sketch all night long. Robert Smigel, who was one of the best writers we had, would write with him a lot. I was a bit envious, of course, because I never had anyone strong on my team. Adam was such a good writer himself that the combo of him and Smigel was lethal. They would be in there laughing like crazy, and I would be at my desk staring at my blank yellow legal pad, no laptops back then, trying to conjure up some shitty bit and usually failing. Adam was perfect for the show because he had an arsenal of characters. When we were bored, he would crank call people and act like he was a woman or do Bernie Brillstein or whatever. We would just laugh our asses off. He was very quick on the phone, which is actually a good indication of whether someone is really funny. I always picture back then just myself sitting at my boring wooden basic desk with my legal pad, nothing on the pages, trying to come up with something. I didn't have a ton of characters. Even though I'm funny, I don't even have a ton of ideas for sketches. I was still figuring it out. I thought I did when I started, but as the show peel away, it's like deja vu Groundhog Day on Monday. They give you another host. You have to think of another fucking sketch for them that no one's done in the last 25 years. It starts to get hard. I think Conan O'Brien explained to me once that my weekend update bits needed a concept and explained it can't be just jokes. I swear this was news to me and it changed the way I wrote. I can't believe I wasn't aware of this. I just was dumb. Concept changed the whole thing. I was just like reading jokes from my act and shit. He was saying come up with a whole thing, a whole angle. One disadvantage I had at the show, I wasn't worldly enough, or even stately, not even a real term. I was so naive about East Coast shit, like that the accents in New York are different than Boston, New Hampshire. I didn't know any of that. And I don't come from a super religious background, so I knew nothing about Jewish or Irish Catholic cultures. It was all foreign to me. I couldn't mine it for jokes like everyone else did, and this frustrated me, and I couldn't sing, and if you can sing, and you can just be used more. I was just getting mad at myself, and I felt stupid. Farrell's didn't write much, or read for that matter, so he was usually getting very bored sitting at his desk. He's very antsy. He's like a kindergartner. I remember going, "David, turn around," and I wouldn't answer, and he'd start again, "David, turn around, it's funny." And I'd go, "I promise it's not going to be worth it," and he goes, No, I got a bit I'm going to try out on you. It's a good one. I go, if this is fat guy in little coat again, I'm not into it. I think that peaked on the charts about a year ago. You go, no, 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 it's not. I got a whole new thing. So I'd stop writing, put my pen down, creak my stiff neck around my chair. And of course, he'd have my little Levi jacket on and go, fat guy in a little coat. David, don't you give up on it. And then we'd laugh because he would really sell it the 98th time he did it. And I go, God damn, let's take a break. You want to go eat? Answer is always yes. We'd grab Rock, Sandler, Tim Meadows, anyone's around, Norm, Quinn, go down to Wally and Joseph's, the mobsterish Italian and steak place within a mile of 30 Rock, which I mentioned before. Some of my best memories of this gig are from walking down to that restaurant there. Tim came sometimes, Schneider. It was always just a band of dipshits walking down the street laughing, blowing off steam, de-stressing in the middle of New York. Chris would always try to make us laugh, usually stopping a girl and asking if they had ID, or by doing push-ups on the street and telling him he was a trainer. I remember once we saw this pretty girl walking in front of us, and Adam goes, Chris, go talk to her. Right then, she hailed a cab. But still, Chris ran up behind her and climbed in the cab with her, saying something like, hey, heading my way, going uptown, I'm Chris, and started to laugh. The girl immediately started kicking and screaming at him, get the fuck out of here. It was pretty funny because if you don't know he's famous, he's just an obnoxious, huge guy possibly trying to attack you. We loved it. Tom Hanks hosted on the 8th show of that season. This was super exciting for all of us. Hanks is a massive star and stays at that level no matter what he does. I naturally was out of ideas, and some mere whisper of an idea was definitely not good enough for a star of his caliber. So I decided to go with the flow Monday and bullshit my way through it. A lot of people, including myself, would give fake ideas when we couldn't think of anything fast enough after the last show. Rob would come in and say something like, you're a caveman afraid of caves. You're a pilot afraid of flying. These types of lame pitches always made us laugh because they actually sound like real ideas, even though we knew they weren't and no one's going to ever write them. Farley usually gave his ideas at the end of the Monday meeting and would fuss and struggle and act all OCD nuts waiting to say his idea, which was always shitty, which is half the hilarity of it. Watching him twist and turn in the wind while it would get closer and closer to him talking, watching him grabbing at the carpet, pulling on the shag, holding his sweaty, crumpled legal pad, grabbing his hair, it's so hilarious. Finally, his term in the Hanks meeting came. Lauren pointed at him and said, Chris, anything for Tom? Chris snapped up his head, pulled his hair, finally spat out, hey, Tom Hanks, says his full name like a total psycho. I was thinking, you know that movie Marty with Ernest Borgnine? Maybe doing something on that. Silence. Everyone stares. Then Lauren shreds him with, well, this is the week. Everyone's going to be looking for our Marty sketch. Cue the whole room laughing because Marty is a movie from like 1954 that no one gives a fuck about. And the pitch makes absolutely no sense, and that's what makes it so funny. When I left the meeting to go eat, I got in Chris's head immediately, of course. I go, Chris, seriously, what the fuck? Marty, are you retarded? Shut up, David, that was my bluff idea. Bluff? Why don't you say cowboy afraid of cows or literally any idea from the last 30 years? Fuck you, all your ideas were shitty too. Tom Hanks was so mad at you. Lauren was breaking pencils back there. Shut up, you don't know anything. It was priceless. Luckily, though, that meeting wasn't a total disaster for me. It turned out Tommy Hanks had a few ideas of his own. This happens sometimes. Maybe the host has met with some writer friends before they came to New York, or if they were on a sitcom, perhaps those writers give him ideas. Sometimes certain hosts are just comedically inclined, and they offer up sketch ideas or impressions they can do, and these little nuggets are very valuable to a writer, but since most of the writers were caught up in their own great sketches, ideas from the host fell on deaf ears. Well, not for Spade. I had no ideas, and my ears were wide open. I knew that writing a sketch with the host always tipped the scales in your favor. The idea that Hanks tossed out that I jumped on was called subway surfing. Everyone else sort of checked out during his pitch, but I sat there soaking it all in. The concept was that Hanks and all the cast would ride the subway around the boroughs of New York, surfing along and singing songs about it. Once he told me there was a song involved, I knew I was in over my head. I could barely manage to write a sketch beginning, middle, and end, and I had absolutely no business trying to write a song. But Hanks was happy that one of the writers liked his idea, so he had a lot of enthusiasm. Plus, he's a good writer too, so he could hack it. I didn't have the heart to tell him that the only reason I went for it was it had surfing in the title, still clinging to my Arizona OP shorts wearing skateboard riding roots. The next step was actually putting pen to yellow legal pad and writing it. I'd sit with Tom for a little bit and we'd hash it out, and then he'd be pulling 50 different directions, and I'd be left to hammer out the details and try to make it all make sense. I would, like, finish a rough draft, let him scope it out, take any ideas he threw out, put them in, and hand it in by the deadline. This should have been simple enough, except Hanks wasn't aware that I couldn't really write. I wasn't Smigel or Jack Handy or Conan. I didn't know what the fuck I was doing. Well, somehow I finished it by read-through and put it in the pile. The best part? Seeing the writers on the corner listed as Hank Spade. This made me feel legit for the first time since I got there. If I had a camera phone back then, I definitely would have snapped a sneaky little pic and posted it on Instabrag, but I didn't have a cell phone at this point. Yes, I'm old, ladies. Sorry. A bit later, the read-through started and subway surfing was on the docket. I was sweating even more than usual because I really wanted this to do well for me and for Hanks. Well, for me, really, he's fine. We read it together and sing the song. Tom gave it everything. He gave everything 100% all the time, but this sketch he gave 101%. It was probably a 7 out of 10 on the laugh-o-meter. More concept and fun than hilarious, if I'm being honest. It was by no means a home run, and for sure in the show. So I went off to Wally and Joseph, sweating it out, pondering why I was losing my hair. Then I sprinted back to see if it was on the board, and it was. The card was on the board on the show. Victory. Then came the hard part. All the department heads asked me to put the sketch together. Wigs, makeup, sets. I bluffed my way through it and ran to Tom for the tricky questions. We threw it up at dress rehearsal and sang our little hearts out. But we just didn't quite nail it. I could tell in the middle we were dead in the water. The crowd liked it, but just wasn't enough laughs there. Much to no one's surprise, it got cut. I was bummed, but he was a class act the whole way. He grabbed me later at the after party and said, "Hey, we tried. I thought it was funny." We laughed, felt a little bit better for about 5 minutes when I had to start thinking material for the next fucking host. One of the impressions in my arsenal, and my arsenal meaning two impressions, was Michael J. Fox. When I learned he was the next host, I was stoked. This could be a big week for me with this in my back pocket. I really needed a solid showing. I still hadn't really done jack shit that season, and my buddy Rob had already scored big with Copy Machine Guy. With Sting, of all people! And I was in a jealous tailspin. Things were already getting a little bit prickly between Rob and me, and this didn't help. I thought him writing himself as the lead in a sketch wasn't cool, because we had been told to write for other people. The fact that the sketch had already been on twice, another ballsy move, writing two sketches for yourself in the lead 2 weeks in a row, by the time he ran it with Sting, felt totally unfair. I was quickly reminded that nothing was fair about SNL. Of course, if the sketch had been mine, I probably would have been more than happy to bend the rules. But generally, I'm a rule follower. I respect the system. Unfortch, it takes ballsy shit like that to get ahead in show business and in life, and I'm not really built like that. SNL was the wrong place to be Mr. Polite Dudley Do-Right. This is an old reference lost on you youngsters who probably won't like this book anyway. Rob, Sandler, and Farley were all blowing past me on rocket ships, and I was scared of getting shit-canned. I hope Michael J. Fox would lift me out of my tailspin. The Monday meeting, I met Michael for the first time. He was very cool, excited, up for anything. Like I said, best kind of host. He knew someone on the staff did an impression of him, and it would probably be on the show, and he seemed fine with that idea. So my spirits were starting to lift. Smigel came up with a sketch about former child stars gone bad, planning a bank robbery, and there's a rumor going around I'd play Michael J. Fox in it. Now I'm stoked. I'm going to get a few crumbs thrown my way this week. They kept me from blowing my brains out. More important, might save my job. I guess the job was less important than dying. That child actor sketch was written and hilarious at read-through. Michael J. Fox played Danny Bonaducci, Farley played Mindy Cohen from The Facts of Life. Just do it, Rippy. And I played Michael J. Fox. Then I got a call in a Lauren's office to talk about the monologue, which I was also rumored to be in. Maybe my days of, "Please, sir, may I have some more?" Oliver Twist, like starving for screen time, were coming to an end? When I got to Lauren's office, he explained to me I was going to indeed be in the monologue along with Michael and Dana Carvey. We'll all be playing Michael J. Fox in a Back to the Future bit. At this point, I was over the moon, but Lauren dropped the whammy. He explained that because I was new and the audience wasn't familiar with me, Dana had to come out first as Michael. And to add insult to injury, I had to coach him on how to do Michael J. Fox impression. Basically, I had to give Carvey the best thing I knew how to do and then follow him and look like a copycat. Shit. I fell in line like a good soldier and went to Dana's office to walk him through it, and he locked into that impression immediately, as predicted. Dana was 10 times better at impressions than anyone on SNL, so this was not a shocker. I went to bed a bit grumbly that night. At dress rehearsal the next night, the monologue was fine, but the sketch about child stars was crazy because when I was playing opposite Fox, dressed as Fox, Michael started laughing. That always makes a sketch crush. But when we did it on air, it still worked, but he didn't laugh this time. So a little spark was lost. It was still a big moment for me, but I couldn't help but wish that dress version was on the air. As if things couldn't get any better than being on the air twice in 1 week. $1,500 paycheck. Cha-ching! I finally had my very first sketch to make it to air. It was called Not Getting Any. It was a talk show consisting of a bunch of guys sitting around complaining about not getting laid. Original! I was on my own, totally in charge of wardrobe, wigs, set design, line readings, getting all the cuts and changes to the script, cue card department, everything. This was quite an undertaking. I quickly realized you have to pace yourself and pick your fights in these situations. You got to stay focused on the decisions that matter. And those are the ones mostly about the jokes. When someone grabs you in the hall and goes, "What kind of couch should you guys be sitting on? Is it modern or more of a cozy L-shaped one? Is it leather?" I just say the first thing that pops into my head or tell them to decide, because leave that shit to someone who's better at those kind of decisions. It played okay. It didn't set the world on fire. But of course, the thing I remember most fondly is something my boy Farley did. I had Chris in the sketch because he was a score machine. I needed him. I wrote a line with him asking a girl if he could lay her down in the tall grass and let me do my stuff. That's a line from a Fleetwood Mac song, but I knew he'd say it in a funny way and make it work. During the rehearsals, he pulled me aside and goes, "Davey, in that sketch, what if I said, I have a weight problem? Hell, my folks don't even know. I swallow a lot of aggression. Along with some pizza." "Can I say that?" I'm like, "Shit, yeah, that's funny." So I added those lines in. The sketch made it through dress rehearsal and by some miracle got on the live show. I was stoked it was finally happening. As I was walking out to the set during the commercial, Farley grabbed me and goes, "This is going to be great, Davey." And I go, "Yeah, I hope so. And that stuff you added killed." Then he got a weird look on his face. And we start to step into the set. And he grabs my arm really hard and he goes, It's just his race. And with the band playing and all the noise, I go, "Wait, what's that?" And he sheepishly goes, I think that was from Stripes. I got a chill down my spine, and it all hit me. "Wait a minute, Chris. Those lines you gave me are something John Candy said in the movie Stripes? Wait, what?" He starts hemming and hawing. "David, no, it's okay. No. And nobody will know. I didn't even care." He was so panicked and guilty, I knew I couldn't use a line from a movie in a sketch. It was stealing. My stomach dropped, and then Joe Dixo, the stage manager, goes, "David, sit down, we got 10 seconds, 5, 4, 3. I glared at Chris as he sat in his seat knowing he'd done something wrong. The sketch went off fine. Afterwards, he grabbed me really hard because he was in trouble. And he goes, "David, don't be mad, it's fine." I go, "Chris, people are going to think I ripped it off because I wrote it." Then he started laughing because he knew he was wrong, but he didn't care. Then he started singing, "Won't you lay me down the tall grass and let me do my stuff," out of nervous energy. And I couldn't help but laugh at this moron. Stuff like that always got him out of trouble with me and everyone else. Scenarios like that are sort of what turned into the movie Tommy Boy, or at least parts of it, which we will get to in a bit. Overall, the Michael J. Fox episode is a victory, but I still didn't think I had made enough of an impact on the show and the season was almost over. I wasn't totally worth keeping yet. It could all go either way, and I could easily be back doing stand-up at the Arkansas Rib Tickler by June.